The Hague Group, which was a diplomatic and institutional initiative to try and use international law to end the genocide in Gaza, in which a number of countries in Latin America had been a part of, including Colombia, Brazil, and Mexico, and Honduras and Bolivia under left-wing governments had also been a part of that. They both recently withdrew just in this last week, as the Hague Group is meeting with 40 countries to try and come up with an institutional response to this. And so you can see, again, how this is about you know, using the hemisphere. And I think sort of ironically, right, much of international law and these concepts of sovereignty really came out of Latin American thinking, and the administration now sort of using that same region to undermine them globally.
And finally, Jake, U.S. commandos joining U.S. special forces in Ecuador, joining Ecuadorian commandos in this last 20 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, this is a hyper-militarized and overtly politicized remix of the war on drugs and the war on terror, right? Ecuador has been begging for the U.S. to get involved in that and since Noboa took power. But this is not about drugs. This is not about terror. I mean, the U.S. pardoned Juan Orlando Hernandez, the convicted drug trafficking former president of Honduras, and Noboa in Ecuador, his own family has been accused of involvement in the drug trade. And so, look, this is about politics. This is about power. This is not about drugs, and this is not about democracy or anything else.
We want to thank you for being with us, Jake Johnston, Director of International Research at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That does it for our show. I'm headed to Savannah, Georgia, where the award-winning documentary Steal the Story, Please, about 30 Years of Democracy Now! Will be at the Hindsight Film Festival at the Ben Tucker Theater at the Otis Johnson Cultural Arts Center. That's Saturday night at 7 p.m. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Tune in to KBOO for our International Women's Day special. Oh, our International Women's Weekend Marathon. One day is not enough.
It's this weekend.
We're kicking things off early Saturday morning, and we won't stop until Monday. Tune in for thoughtful discussion in English and Spanish, coverage of the issues that trans and incarcerated women are facing, and celebrations of women in music. That's KBOO's International Women's Weekend on your community connection, KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from interviews with Charles Chambry, presenting the Spring Awakening Fashion Show on March 15th at Nomadic Vintage Rugs, featuring runway fashion, spring-inspired designs, and a night of style and culture in Portland. More information available at shorturl.at/TBF2Z.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers pass bills to the governor's desk as the short legislative session nears its end.
Demolition and redevelopment of the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland moves forward.
And in international news, the sole Iranian Paralympian won't be able to compete in Milan.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 6th, 2026. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Oregon lawmakers passed a controversial bill on campaign finance yesterday. Good government groups say if Governor Tina Kotek signs it, they'll launch a ballot measure campaign and even a constitutional amendment campaign to limit how legislators can change campaign finance law. HB 4018 revises a campaign finance law passed by a coalition in 2024. Its first requirements were set to start next year. Oregon is one of only a few states with no limits on campaign contributions and has some of the most expensive elections in the country. The 2024 law created contribution limits and required disclosure of where those funds came from, beyond the name of the political action group. The newly passed bill kicks many requirements down the road And advocates say it punches new loopholes in favor of keeping moneyed interests in politics. Disclosure requirements wouldn't start until 2031. The new bill also removes penalties for illegally large contributions until 2030. It also removes limits on so-called coordinated expenditures, spending made in cooperation or at the request of a candidate. Senator Jeff Golden of Ashland voted against the bill. Golden said, quote, "I don't see how we can hope to retain public trust if we endorse a process like this by passing this bill," end quote. HB 4018 awaits the governor's signature.
Oregon lawmakers pass a bill to help wrongfully convicted Oregonians and to better compensate them for their time in prison for a crime they didn't commit. SB 1515 creates a legal pathway for people to prove their innocence if they were convicted based on junk science. Street Roots reporter Jake Thomas spoke to KABU about this bill ahead of the legislative session.
Other states, they have a process for people to be able to challenge their convictions if it was based on some kind of science or some kind of forensics discipline that was later found to be faulty. Oregon tried to pass a bill regarding that to have a similar process, but it also died because it ended up costing money. And what this bill does, it would create a mechanism where somebody who's challenged under three specific discredited forensic disciplines would be able to challenge their conviction in court. It would just create that really straightforward pathway. These three discredited forensic science methods, they're, you know, like widely debunked, and they include a thing called comparative lead analysis. The FBI has said that they are not confident with this method and they're going to stop using it. And what that is it's basically where a lab will take lead that they, traces of lead that they get from a crime scene, and they'll go to somebody's house. And if they own firearms, they'll look at the ammunition that the person has in their house, and they'll do this comparison, and they'll say the lead from the bullets that this person has in their house matches the lead that was found at the crime scene. And that's been found to just not be a reliable forensic discipline. So it would give people who've been convicted using this forensic discipline a means of challenging their conviction. There's two others, microscopic hair comparisons, where investigators will find hair at a crime scene and they'll link it to the alleged perpetrator. And that's been found to just not be reliable. It's like there's been times they found like dog hairs or things that aren't even hairs. And they'll say that this matches the perpetrator and they link it to the crime scene. But that's just also been found to just not be reliable. And the third one is compared to bite mark analysis, where maybe there's the victim bit the perpetrator and they'll take a look at the victim's teeth and they'll match it to the bite mark. And that's also been found to not be reliable. So the widely debunked, it's widely agreed that they shouldn't be used. But there's still people who, people have been convicted in Oregon using these methods. But right now they don't have a means of challenging their conviction.
That was Street Roots reporter Jake Thomas speaking about a recently passed bill in the Oregon legislature intended to give people convicted of a crime based on junk science a way to prove their innocence. The bill also changes the Oregon Justice for Exonerees Act. That act was meant to compensate people who were wrongfully convicted, but the process to get that compensation was a big obstacle. Exonerees would have to go back to court to fight for money they were legally owed in an adversarial process that advocates described as re-traumatizing. Janice Percol is the executive director of the Forensic Justice Project. Percol said in a statement, quote, "When science evolves and we learn that methods once trusted are no longer reliable, our legal system has a responsibility to respond. This legislation reinforces our commitment to justice, fairness, and restoring dignity to those who have been wrongfully convicted," end quote. The bill now heads to the governor's desk for signature.
Demolition of the Lloyd Center Mall in Northeast Portland is expected to begin this year and will officially be decided by March 20th. This week, the Portland Design Commission accepted the master plan for redevelopment, which focuses on zoning and infrastructure. Developers purchased the Lloyd Center in 2021. They plan to redevelop the whole district to include parks, stores, housing, and a music venue. The Northeast Portland Mall has been in decline over the past decade, similar to other malls across the country. After the traditional stores that anchored the mall left, cheap rents attracted a variety of quirky small businesses. That's helped create a sense of community, one that some folks don't want to lose. The latest development plan doesn't include an ice rink, leaving the closest ice skating rinks in Vancouver, Sherwood, and Beaverton. Talk of the coming demolition brought people together to fight to keep the place alive because of the newfound community they built. On March 20th, the city staff decision on the redevelopment plan will be finalized. After that, there will be a 2-week window to appeal. If an appeal is filed, the city council will hold a hearing to consider the case.
Some Washington lawmakers are proposing to dip into the state's Climate Commitment Act fund in order to address the state's budget shortfall, and Washington residents are pushing back. The act provides funding for several heat pump rebate programs, among other priorities. Isabel Charlet reports.
Washingtonians are urging lawmakers to preserve Climate Commitment Act funds for their intended uses rather than diverting them to cover the state's budget shortfall. Passed in 2024, the state's cap and investment program lets major polluters buy emission allowances, funding efforts like environmental justice programs and rebates for electric appliances. Mike O'Brien with EcoSpark Heat Pump says the Home Electrification and Appliance Rebates Program, which is funded through the law, has made heat pumps accessible to families that would have not been able to afford them otherwise.
It really helps homeowners, especially moderate income homeowners, to say, hey, for about the same price as a gas furnace, I can now get into a heat pump, be doing the right thing, and have a much more comfortable living experience.
Faced with a budget shortfall of over $4 billion, Governor Bob Ferguson's initial budget proposed taking about $570 million from the Climate Commitment Act to go towards the working families tax credit. The House has proposed taking about half that, while the Senate's budget does not dip into the CCA at all. Christine Schaefer recently replaced her home's oil furnace with a heat pump and received a rebate through the CCA. She says rebates knocked $6,600 off the final price and calls her heat pump fabulous.
Our house is warmer than it's ever been. I don't have to worry about sending fumes out into the environment. It is efficient and ecologically friendly.
Heat pumps typically reduce energy usage by up to 75% compared to traditional systems, leading to lower utility bills. Advocates say rebate programs are an important step in helping the state reach its carbon emissions goals. The legislature needs to negotiate the final state budget by March 12th. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
A record number of Texas Democrats voted in Tuesday's primary election, and incumbent Senator John Cornyn is headed into a runoff against Attorney General Ken Paxton. As Frieda Ross reports, Texans are using the ballot box to signal that change could be on the horizon.
Texas Republicans will return to the polls in May to select their candidate to run for the U.S. Senate. Incumbent Senator John Cornyn didn't receive enough votes in Tuesday's primary to beat Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Southern Methodist University political science professor Cal Gilson says Cornyn represents the old-school Republican Party.
The Bush wing has faded and the MAGA wing of the party is in the saddle. So the question is whether Cornyn can survive this, because Paxton is seen as more of a knife fighter who will toe the Republican line and follow Donald Trump and the MAGA base of the party.
President Donald Trump hasn't endorsed either candidate. The runoff election is slated for May 26th. The winner of the contest will square off against State Representative James Tallarico. A record number of Democrats participated in the primary, outpacing Republicans. Gilson says that increases the chances that Democrats have a chance of winning a Senate seat in Texas.
Republicans have a lot of work to do to build enthusiasm for their candidates and for the positions of their party on basic economic issues, affordability issues, and now on use of force overseas, because a lot of Republicans traditionally were for no more foreign wars.
The last time a Democrat won a U.S. Senate seat in the Lone Star State was in 1988. The president was in Texas last week. Gilson says that could be a sign that Republicans are worried.
It's not a good story for the Republicans, who traditionally have many, many more voters vote in their primary than the Democrats do in theirs. That switched around this time, and it suggests an excited Democratic Party and a little bit of a bewildered Republican Party.
I'm Frieda Ross, Texas News Service.
Kristi Noem is fired from her position as Homeland Security Secretary, but moves to a new and unclear role. The Senate Majority Leader blames Democrats for the ongoing DHS shutdown, and the House fails to advance a war powers resolution for Iran. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're going to have to secure our border and make sure we're going after dangerous criminal illegals and remove them from our country. And every day, we're going to have to make tough decisions to uphold the law, to make sure the consequences for breaking the law are put in place as well.
After a harsh grilling in the Senate, Kristi Noem has been fired as Homeland Security Secretary. She led President Donald Trump's mass deportation effort, but was criticized when agents killed two Minnesota protesters, whom she falsely called domestic terrorists. Senators also accused her of mismanagement, delaying emergency relief contracts while spending extravagantly, including $200 million for ads telling people without legal status to leave the country voluntarily. Trump tapped Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen to replace her. Noem is moving to an as-yet-undefined role as special envoy to a new effort called the Shield of the Americas. Congress is no closer to funding her old department. Since the Minneapolis shootings, Democrats have demanded reforms, notably a uniform code of conduct for federal agents requiring body cameras but forbidding masks. Senate Majority Leader John Thune calls it a political ploy.
If Democrats really wanted to put reforms in place, they'd be doing everything they can to get a bill. Of course, the White House isn't going to sign off on every Democrat demand. No side gets everything it wants in negotiations.
House Democrats have introduced a bill to fund all DHS agencies with the exception of ICE and CBP. Connecticut Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro says the Speaker is preventing it from getting a vote, instead favoring the agency's, quote, lawless. DeLauro and other Democrats say the Republicans would rather have immigration as an issue than work to fix it. She points to a bipartisan border security compromise reached at the end of the Biden administration, which died when Thune and almost all Republicans voted against it at the request of then-candidate Trump. North Carolina's Senate race is already heating up as Democratic former Governor Roy Cooper prepares to face former Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley. Both of the state's current senators are Republicans, but Kirk Beto with Insider Politics website The Hotline says Democrats like their chances in the battleground.
Governor Roy Cooper has never lost a statewide election. He has all that money on hand. He left relatively very popular in North Carolina, too, which is saying something in a 50-50 state like that.
Both the House and the Senate have now failed to pass war powers resolutions that would limit Trump's authority to attack Iran. A handful of Republicans did support the House version, including isolationist Republican Kentucky Representative Thomas Massey.
Why are we going to war with Iran? We owe our military service members a clear mission. And American families in my district want to know how this is going to help them pay for groceries.
Iran is continuing its own attacks in more than a dozen countries, including most of the Gulf region. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 44 degrees. And tomorrow's weather will be rainy as well with a high of 59 degrees. Today in history, in 1957, Ghana became the first sub-Saharan African country to gain independence from British rule. The quote of the day is from former Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who said, quote, "If I were dying, my last words would be, have faith and pursue the unknown end."
Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is Trump's new pick to be the Secretary of Homeland Security. If he's confirmed, he would be the first Native American man and Cherokee Nation citizen to serve on the cabinet. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. is congratulating U.S. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. On Thursday, President Donald Trump appointed Mullen to lead the Department of Homeland Security. Mullen is Cherokee Nation and would reportedly be the first Native American to head the agency if confirmed. Hoskin, in a statement, said, "Having a Cherokee Nation citizen serve within the U.S. cabinet is a mark of high esteem for his tribe." Hoskin said the appointment reflects the resilience and leadership of Cherokee people. Arizona Humanities Council is once again teaming up with an indigenous nonprofit to organize an all-day celebration of a unique food from the Southwest. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrovazio has more on Saturday's gathering.
Blue corn is not only nutritious, it's also synonymous with traditional ceremonies across this arid land. Amber McCrary is Diné and the program's manager with Arizona Humanities, and she says that's why, for the second year running, a festival named after this desert crop is taking root in downtown Phoenix.
It's always been there in my life, and I would just like to see it kind of become this bigger thing that we will all celebrate together.
This time around, the festival is tied to a Smithsonian initiative where each state is responsible for hosting a single folklife event this year in honor of the country's 250th anniversary. And for Arizona, that theme is blue corn. Through food, art, and storytelling, even down to the wardrobe, says Diné co-organizer Kinsale Drake, founder of the Indian Girls Book Club.
If you are coming to the festival, wear your best blue. We have a dress code.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
You can count on it like the steady beat of a Native drum. Dancers across the generations fill up the hospital lobby at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the kids are the one to watch.
These days, we mostly see Alaska Native dance groups on a stage. But in the hospital lobby, the dancing is not meant to be a performance. Instead, a shared experience. The rhythms are almost hypnotic. Yet the dancers are fully present. Everyone is seated within a circle of sound and motion that spirals out from a small group of drummers.
In Yupik, we say yurak, not dance.
Kyle Watson is 12 years old, a sixth grader. He's here every Wednesday. His movements are sharp and precise, as if every fiber of his being snaps to the beat of the drum.
It just makes me happy.
The excitement that comes out of Kyle's throat comes from way down deep. A throwback to a technique his ancestors used to excite the dancers and encourage them to pick up their pace. Kyle's grandfather, Percy Alexi, usually stands in the back of the room to watch.
I'm proud of him. He makes it fun. And I'm proud to say he taught himself.
I'm Rhonda McBride.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Iran's only competitor at the Paralympics in Milan Cortina will not compete in the Games because of the ongoing war begun by a joint U.S.-Israel attack on Iran last week. Abul Fazl Khatibi was scheduled to compete in two cross-country skiing events but cannot travel safely to Italy. International Paralympics Committee President Andrew Parsons said, quote, "It is really disappointing for world sport and especially for Abul Fazl that he is unable to travel safely to compete," end quote. He added, quote, "To not compete at a Paralympic Winter Games because of factors outside of his control after years of training and dedication is heartbreaking for the athlete, and our sympathies are with Abul Fazl at this difficult time," end quote. The IPC and Games organizers have been working since the war's outbreak to find alternative routes for the safe passage of the Iran delegation, but ultimately felt, quote, the risk to human life is too high. Because the athlete will be absent, Iran's flag was not included in the athlete parade during the opening ceremony. Parsons called the Middle East war a, quote, breach of the Olympic truce, and he pointed out that this is the third time in four Paralympic Winter Games that there was a conflict initiated between the Olympics and Paralympics. Parsons was referring to Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea and its invasion of Ukraine 4 years ago. The other athletes will compete in six different sports spread across three sites in the north of Italy.
As the construction industry grapples with its massive carbon footprint, researchers at the University of Miami are developing a solution rooted in Florida's own coastal waters, turning algae into a sustainable concrete additive. The project recently earned the Volo Foundation's VISTA Award, which recognizes student-led innovation in climate solutions. KBOO's Eden Salmon has the details.
Concrete is the second most used material in the world after water, and the cement industry alone accounts for roughly 8% of global carbon emissions. Researchers at the University of Miami are tackling that problem by turning algae into a sustainable concrete additive. They're partnering with an aquaculture lab on university's campus in Key Biscayne, which grows Florida native algae for research purposes. Jasmine Rodriguez, a first-year PhD student in civil engineering, says the goal is to significantly reduce concrete's climate impact. And for her team, it starts with the algae grown just minutes from their lab,
which we then turn into a biochar, which is basically like a charcoal material made of that algae, which we can then functionalize, which is like chemically treating it, in order to make it easier to replace in higher contents of cement.
The challenge, Rodriguez explains, is that replacing too much cement with the biochar can compromise concrete strength. The team is developing techniques to make the biochar more chemically reactive so it bonds better with the cement. The researchers present their work at the Climate Correction Conference in Orlando from March 10th to 11th. Farzad Racharity, also a PhD student in civil engineering, says the team is exploring multiple strategies to lock carbon into concrete permanently. Beyond replacing cement with carbon-rich algae biochar, they are also experimenting with what is known as carbon curing.
In this way, we are going to store carbon dioxide in a stable shape in a concrete, and this is another way to actually to reduce carbon emission through actually carbon sequestration through actually this material that we have.
The research team received a $25,000 grant through Volo Foundation's VISTA Award. The funding will help the group purchase updated equipment to better control the production of biochar. Rodriguez notes that while the technology is still in the experimental stage, the long-term goal is to patent their techniques and eventually establish industry partners to bring Florida-grown sustainable concrete to the market. For KBOO News and Public News Service, I'm Eden Selman.
Offshore wind could help the electrical grid. Offshore turbines generate electricity reliably at night and in the winter. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Across the U.S., AI data centers, electric vehicles, and energy-intensive industries are driving a surge in the demand for electricity. But at the same time, some older power plants are retiring, and in many areas, the grid is struggling to keep up with growing energy needs.
The grid is in trouble. I don't think the general public knows how serious the situations that we're seeing.
Oliver Stover of the consulting firm Charles River Associates co-authored a report that shows that offshore wind can help. A single offshore wind turbine can power thousands of homes. And Stover says offshore wind can complement other power sources. In many areas, it reliably generates power at night, when solar panels do not. And in winter, when bad weather can disrupt natural gas plants.
Wind generation is materially stronger at night and much, much stronger in the winter. So this creates this really fantastic synergy with the resources that we already have on the grid now.
Despite federal pushback, developers have been building offshore wind farms near New England, New York, and Virginia, coastal areas with growing energy demands. So abundant ocean winds could soon help feed a hungry power grid with clean energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to The Point Puzzle. It's a weekly radio brain teaser produced by Pearl Stark at KPOV Bend. On this week's puzzle, wordplay and country capitals.
For the new puzzle, start with a capital city of a country in three syllables. Change the internal consonant sounds, and you have the capital city of a bordering country. So again, start with the capital city of a country in three syllables, change the two internal consonant sounds, and you have the capital city of a bordering country. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of March 2nd. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 6th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Eden Selman. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Jill Freitas, Pearl Stark, Frida Ross, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming,